It's 8:30. Just a moment, please. Hey, Michael. Oh, Michael has his own ID tag now. Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Wednesday, May 17th, 2017. Thank you all for being here. Today will be another in our series of informational hearings. Today we're going to talk about three issue areas. We're going to talk a little bit about the Oregon Promise and kind of get some information about how it's been rolled out so far in the first year. And on the community college front, we're also going to talk a little bit about property taxes, which is an issue that was brought up by the committee during the HEC budget testimony, and kind of how that plays into their funding formula, as well as some specifics about some of the high cost programs, the high cost and I would argue high return programs that are in many community colleges. So I'd like to start with the Oregon Promise, and I have listed on the agenda Ben Cannon from the HEC, Juan Baez Arevalo, also from the HEC, but OSAC specifically. I don't know if you guys want to all come up together or one at a time. Patrick Crane and Andrea Henderson. Somebody could sit on somebody else's lap if there's only three chairs there. Although none of you look like Andrea.
No.
There's Andrea.
You may want to have her come up later.
Okay. I was going to say, you guys can kind of pick and array yourselves. So, Andrea, you're not legally required to come forward yet if you're not ready.
Whatever.
Sit in between.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I feel like I should take a back seat. I have relatively little to say this morning other than to introduce myself, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and then introduce our terrific and talented staff, Juan Baez Arevalo, who's the interim director of OSAC within the HEC, and Patrick Crane, the director of our Office of Community College and Workforce Development for the HEC. And Chair, you laid it out nicely in terms of the request and the information that we're presenting today. So I think we'll jump right in by turning it over to Juan.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, for the record, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Juan Baez Arevalo. I serve as HEC's Interim Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, OSAC. I have the privilege this morning to follow up with you, along with Dr. Patrick Crane, as we share with you a good bit of information on the Oregon Promise. I'll begin this morning with a short review of the Oregon Promise to remind us all of the existing structure of the program, followed by some initial data that we have thus far. And Dr. Crane will review the good work of the community colleges in regards to House Bill 4076 of the 2015 session and the Oregon Promise Support Services, Student Support Services. We'll conclude our presentation with a detailed review of the social demographic data, cost projections, cost controls, cost drivers, and some uncertainties and unknowns, information that I believe you'll want to receive and review. So let's first take a look at the Oregon Promise. The Oregon Promise was created by Senate Bill 81 of the 2015 session to provide a waiver of tuition for community college courses. The grant applies after federal and state aid grants. It is a last dollar model, and students may be eligible up to 90 credits, which is the equivalent of about 2 years of full-time enrollment. And the grant sizes vary from the minimum of $1,000 to a maximum of $3,397 for this academic year, which is the average community college tuition. The goal of the program is to increase college enrollment, completion, and affordability for recent high school graduates and GED recipients. So let's review who is eligible for the Oregon Promise. A student must be a recent Oregon High School graduate or GED recipient, must have a 2.5 cumulative GPA or higher, must have no more than 90 credits completed or attempted, and be an Oregon resident at least 12 months prior to attendance, and most importantly, plan to attend an Oregon community college within 6 months of graduation. It is worth mentioning again that the Oregon Promise is a last dollar program that builds upon other federal and state aid. Here you have three different examples. Student A has a lower expected family contribution, or EFC. The student qualifies for the Pell Grant, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and receives a small amount of Oregon Promise Grant. Student B has a higher expected family contribution, still qualifies for the Pell Grant, receives a larger Oregon Opportunity Grant, and a larger Oregon Promise Grant. On the other hand, student C has the highest expected family contribution and does not qualify for Pell or the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and subsequently the Oregon Promise is its sole last dollar source of tuition funding for this particular student. I have a good deal of information to share with you, so we'll do a quick review, and if you have any questions, please do not hesitate to ask. You've seen this funnel before. This funnel represents visually the volume of qualified high school graduates in 2016 down to the actual number that received an award in the same year, with 19,223 Oregon Promise applications submitted. You can envision the large volume of work that OSAC staff have to process. Of all those students, 6,797 were enrolled in Oregon community colleges and received the grants. Some students went on to a public university. The Oregon Promise students, the distribution of Oregon Promise recipients by Pell Award amount is quite telling. It confirms that the majority of the recipients, or 53%, have a higher family income and therefore do not qualify for the federal Pell Award. As previously indicated, with the example of student C, the amount of the Oregon Promise Award for these students there in yellow, the 53, there is no federal Pell and also no Oregon Opportunity Grant for them to cover tuition expenses and the Oregon Promise.
Can I ask two quick questions about this slide?
Certainly.
First, the percentages, are those number of students or amount of money?
Those are percentages of students, actual.
So 53% of the students who received the Oregon Promise, or 53% of the funds that were spent on the Oregon Promise?
53% of the funds that were spent.
No.
This is number of students.
Really? Okay. Thank you. That surprises me. That is not what I figured. And then number two, could you review for us, if you have it briefly, what kind of the EFC cutoff is for any Pell at all?
It's about $5,200.
Okay.
EFC.
And that works out to about what for? There's so many variables, I realize, for family
income. Income. And mm-hmm. we're going to review that information.
Okay, great.
Here shortly in some slides. So we'll get into the details.
Okay, but if you have, but if you have EFC of 5,200, expected family contribution of 5,200,
or less,
you qualify for a Pell. Above that, you do not qualify for a Pell.
Correct.
Super. Thank you.
So moving on, the high school graduates. This compares the high school graduates in 2016 and the recipients of the Oregon Promise. The recipients, as you can see, for fall 2016 are as diverse as the 2015-16 high school graduates in our state. It is clear that we have some outreach work to do, that's an ongoing job to increase and maintain the participation of the various subgroups. And as you know, every single generation of high school graduates will look and be different. This next chart provides you with the representation of the Oregon Promise recipients by institution. I would note that Portland Community College and Chemeketa Community College have the largest number of Oregon Promise grant recipients, but also the Oregon Central Coast Community College data is embedded in the Portland Community College data. So,
okay.
It used to be in Clatsop. It's now Portland.
Gotcha. Yep. Thank you.
Now, this next chart is a very similar chart, but it provides you with the Oregon Promise recipients as a percentage of college FTE. This chart reflects the Oregon Promise recipients in the fall. And it is important to keep in mind that when viewing this chart, that Oregon community colleges have a large number of students at any time. Not all of them, perhaps, attend college on a full-time basis. So this is a snapshot of Oregon Promise recipients just in the fall term of 2016. It reminds us that predominantly these students are attending full-time or close to full-time. The information does suggest that recent high school graduates are more likely to attend full-time under the Oregon Promise grant. Something to keep in mind, and as you know, full-time enrollment is highly correlated with completion. So research begs the question, so that the Oregon Promise changed Oregon high school graduates' enrollment in higher education. The preliminary results that we have do indicate that while community college enrollment rates decline, an increase did occur among recent high school graduates as a result of the Oregon Promise. University enrollment for this time period declined slightly. Who is participating in the Oregon Promise? About half of those recipients come from lower-income families who are eligible for the Pell. While most Oregon Promise dollars do go to recipients in higher incomes, the total participation is significant at 6,787 students. And those that received the grant in the fall, the award summed over $4 million for that term. I will now turn it over to Dr. Patrick Crane.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Crane. I'm the Director of Community College and Workforce Development at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I've just got a few slides to show you, and I'll be talking a little bit about House Bill 4076 and funding that was provided to enable the colleges to provide a first-year experience for all Oregon Promise students. So House Bill 4076 in 2016 provided support for Oregon Promise recipients and first-year students who were enrolled after high school in order to help them access wraparound services, integrate with their colleges more successfully, and generally provide them the supports they need to be successful in college. The total amount of the allocation was just under $1.7 million. This broke down to approximately $83,000 per college, with Portland Community College receiving four shares because of their four campuses. The required elements of this first-year experience program, or of the grant, excuse me, were that there be a first-year experience for students. It was up to the community colleges themselves to determine what that looked like and how they wanted to develop something to meet the particular needs of their community. There needed to be a student success team, and there needed to be professional development for faculty and staff in order to provide intentional strategic interventions. I think also this funding was a recognition that if there was going to be an increase in the number of students coming to college, that community colleges would need some additional supports in order to help those students land successfully, integrate, be retained, and then be ultimately successful.
And Patrick, excuse me, are you going to give a couple examples of what first-year experience might meant at some of these schools?
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
And again, just to reiterate, the colleges receiving these funds had to provide support services at each campus, and they had to implement multi-year strategies that incorporated elements of student services, staff development, et cetera. The idea was to look at best practices that were out there and apply those with this funding for the different colleges.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, we go back two slides, please. Thank you. This is Ways and Means. We're going to be talking about, I think there's some question about whether that's a one-time or two-time or how long that support number was for, correct? Because I think working closely with Representative Johnson, we assumed that was a one-time and not a every year going to.
This funding is included in the HEC's governor's request budget moving forward into the next biennium.
Madam Chair, I don't believe it's part of CSL, though, of which the committee will be working off of. I'll verify that, but I don't believe it is.
Thank you. Senator Roblin?
Oh, yeah, I agree that we had some one-time money. We chose to spend it this way. I don't think that means that we intended it not to go forward. We tended to look and see if it had any effect and then make rational decisions on whether or not we should continue it. Right. But it was actual one-time money because it was what we had this package for. And so it should not be in the CSL. I agree with that. But I think it bears a conversation once we know whether or not that money had any effect on keeping kids in school to have a conversation about it in Ways and Means. But
Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank my colleagues for their comments. I agree with what you're saying, except the fact that if we train a teacher to do this, next year she doesn't have to be retrained. It's got to be less money. And I keep asking how many of went with a contract service versus training their own staff and teachers. And I know there's going to be a turnover of staff that would need, but it shouldn't be as large a number, I would think. But that's, we'll see. Okay.
Thank you. Senator Roblin?
I would just say that training teachers is the least expensive part. Hiring teachers to provide the service is the most expensive part. So, okay, so now we only need $1.659 million instead of $1.7 million. But yes, there should be some cost savings with regard to that, other than there's sometimes inflation.
Just trying to help your leadership.
I know. I'm just saying. Anyway.
And if I could point out, the language on this slide is that it provides support services for first years, including the Oregon Promise, not just for.
Correct.
The Oregon Promise students.
That's absolutely true.
Madam Co-Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
So I think, Co-Chairs, Representative Wisnett, this slide, and I'll provide some context about this, will provide some context about how the money was used, which could inform decisions about whether it's one-time or ongoing use funding. Looking at actually how the money was spent by the community colleges, they aligned with the requirements set out in House Bill 4076. The largest category of investment was personnel. This was hiring additional counselors, providing financial counseling to students, paying for faculty and staff to offer additional sections, first-year experience courses, in some cases student tutors or student advisors to help connect students to the campus. Each college decided what their needs were and used the funding to meet those needs. Based on follow-up communications I've had with the colleges about what they would do with additional funding were they to receive it, many of them said that they would either continue these first-year experience programs or expand them so that it wasn't limited only to Oregon Promise recipients or only to first-time, full-time freshmen, but to enroll as many students as possible in these programs. The second largest category of funding was professional development. This included a combination of faculty and staff who were able to attend conferences and trainings, either in Oregon or nationally. It also included bringing in speakers or trainers to the campus so that more staff were able to receive training. This could be about advising, this could be about first-year experience, student engagement, financial literacy, et cetera. IT development was the third largest category. This was largely driven by two community colleges, Columbia Gorge and Blue Mountain Community College, which used their funding or portions of their funding to develop online student advising and first-year experience programs. That was a need they recognized at their college. They were also accompanied by in-person, on-site welcome orientations in the case of Blue Mountain and in-person advising as well for Columbia Gorge. The last few categories, supplies, curriculum program development, direct student support, these were to essentially provide the materials necessary to have orientation programs or whatever materials were necessary to provide supplies for new advisors, et cetera. I think the direct student support is just worth noting, particularly in the case of Treasure Valley. They use Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario. They use some of these funds for student advisors and student ambassadors. And at Clatsop Community College, they recognize that their first semester of trying to engage students with on-campus orientation activities, they weren't able to enroll or engage as many students as they wanted to because they're working, they have busy lives, and they weren't able to be on campus as often. So they redirected some of the funds to provide textbook support for Oregon Promise students to lower their cost of attendance. Madam Co-Chair, to your question about what does a first-year experience look like, this is after reviewing all 17 community colleges, recognizing that there is variance amongst them, but these are generally what a first-year experience would look like. So by and large, it is a 1 to 3 credit course taught in person and online that orients students to the college. It provides them with skills that they need to be successful in college, including study skills, financial literacy, critical thinking, leadership, career exploration, a variety of programs. The curricula do vary somewhat by institution, but these are the sort of main themes that are addressed.
Senator Monroe.
And at Mount Hood anyway, and I'm sure at other community colleges, when we started offering those kinds of courses, we found that the number of students that we retained and that continued greatly increased, that those kind of preparatory courses made a huge difference in retention. Is that pretty much true across the community colleges? I mean, my experience is at Mount Hood, so I know it's true there. But is that something that's pretty much true across all of our community colleges?
Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, yes, that is true. Juan will get to that later in some of his slides, but the HEC submitted a report to the legislature at the end of last month about 4076, and there's a table that looked specifically at fall to winter retention rates for Oregon Promise students compared with a similar cohort from, I think, either 1 or 2 years prior. And there's a 7% increase in retention for Oregon Promise students. We could not definitively say this is a directly result of the first year experience, but I think the fact that there is a 7% increase in retention amongst these students, that's not insignificant.
Right. Thank you.
Just to conclude briefly here, a couple more points about what a first year experience looks like. Again, there's an in-person component as well, campus orientation, welcome events, multiple contacts with advisors and staff. The research literature on student retention really emphasizes the fact that when students engage with the campus community and make personal connections at the institution, they're more likely to be retained for additional semesters. Mandatory advising, also a component of the first year experience. And these courses were open to all students, but mandatory for Oregon Promise students. In a couple instances, they were also mandatory for other first-time, full-time students or other recent high school graduates attending community college. Happy to answer any questions, or we can turn it back to Juan.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Johnson's watching us and giving me feedback here, but I want to pass on that he was just at a conference that he was saying how everyone was envious of Oregon's success with this program, and how we're the main thing is with this bill, how it, and I'm, because I'm not against the training, that's really enabled our students to stay in school and succeed. So, from the peanut gallery.
Indeed. Go ahead.
Thank you. Next, we will review the social demographic data, cost projections, and cost control models that I believe you are all very interested in. The next several slides will be referring to expected family contribution. It is a measure of financial need, and EFC is used as an indicator of the student or the family's ability to pay for college. The lower the EFC, the higher the financial need. And as you know, the EFC is used to determine the eligibility for the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the federal Pell Grant. Okay. Now, this table provides you with a great amount of detailed information, and what you have here is details under various EFC ranges, short EFC ranges, shorter than you've seen them before. What this table includes is the median parent adjusted gross income, which was a question from Madam Co-Chair. Also, the number of Oregon recipients in that EFC range, the average grant amount of disbursement in the fall, and the percent of total full funds that were disbursed under each one of the EFC ranges, as well as the average high school GPA for each one of the EFC ranges. Quite surprising information for us to reflect on. As you can see, the largest number of recipients were students in the first three EFC ranges. About 46% of disbursements went to students in those lowest EFC ranges, with the largest being those who have an EFC of zero in terms of number of students. It is worth noting that the students eligible for the Pell Grant, Madam Co-Chair, are those with that EFC of 5,234, according to the footnote that we have here. So less than that, they would qualify for the Pell Grant.
If I could request just to send us a straight up number dividing at that EFC line, just a total number above and below that, that'd be helpful.
Above and below
the Pell cutoff.
Yes.
Thank you, because you can almost figure it out here, but that third line, you'd have to tweak it in there somewhere.
Certainly.
Thank you.
We will follow up. Also, the GPAs, I think it's interesting to note that the GPA levels per EFC are perhaps a bit higher than some I have expected. Do you have any thoughts, questions, or reflections on this information? No? Hearing none, I'll move on to the next table.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
It's just dramatic that family income doesn't seem to have much correlation to GPA. I think that's interesting. Students from very poor families can get good grades in high school if they apply themselves, and then they qualify for these programs. And it doesn't seem to make much difference if they come from relatively wealthy families. They still do well and get good grades, but it's about the same.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So this table details the EFC range and the race ethnicity of the 2016 recipients. A couple of items to note. It's a bit of a busy table. There is some income discrepancy between race ethnic subgroups across the EFC ranges, yet there's diversity of income or EFC ranges within each one of the ethnic subgroups. As you can see, the white non-Hispanic do have a larger percentage of students in the higher EFC ranges, but do keep in mind that they are the largest participating subgroup. There are several outliers that you can see. For example, in the Hispanic population, 8.1% of Hispanic representation in the 35,000 to 39,999 range, and 7% in the 40,000 to 59,999 EFC range. Any questions, thoughts before I move on to the next slide? Now, retention rates. This table highlights the relatively high retention rates for all EFC ranges. As was discussed, this is attributed to the good work that is being done at the community colleges. As you can see, there are no significant discrepancies in retention rates across the EFCs. The highest retention rate at 91.9% is attributed to those students with an EFC of $1 to 4,999, so all of them in that Pell Grant eligibility criteria. The lowest retention rate at 85.4 is for those students with an EFC range of $60,000 to $79,999.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Retention rates for non-Oregon Promise students, I believe, are closer to 50% or so. These figures are much higher than that. And it would tend to tell me that the Oregon Promise somehow is incentivizing retention pretty dramatically.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There's certainly a high retention rate for the Oregon Promise students, as we've seen, and the efforts of the community college, and together with the incentives of having the promise available to them and maintaining that promise, is something that would keep students certainly in school. And that first year experience is critical and of critical importance, yep, and how it's been applied.
Just to supplement that, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, there are a few uniquenesses to Oregon Promise students besides the fact they're getting the Oregon Promise Award. They are, of course, directly out of high school, just about all of them, or directly out of GED for a few of them. They are much more likely than the typical community college student to be enrolled full-time. Yeah. That has something to do with the fact that they're coming directly from high school and they look more like traditional college students than the majority of community college students who are, you know, average in their mid to, you know, mid-20s. They're less traditional. So this, it is certainly true that these are higher rates than the overall community college retention rates. The comparison that we think would be most valid is to compare them with previous cohorts of direct from high school students whose retention rates are lower than this, but not as low likely as what you were describing.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, and I just want to get at that more because this is also retention from one term to the next.
Right.
A lot of the retention stuff we see is retention for the 2 years in a community college as opposed to the one or the other ones. We haven't got that data because we haven't been there for 2 years. And so I think there's a lot of variables that we don't know other than the fact that I appreciate that they have looked at the retention from one term to another for students in previous cohorts and found that to be a little lower. I appreciate that. But it's so early in the system to bounce too much stuff on. Though I will say, with the highest retention rates being in some of the poor groups, I'm really heartened by that because it's also hard to have 91.9 if your total in is 1,343 as opposed to 65. Mm-hmm. Retention rates with that many kids means that it's carrying throughout the whole cohort, which is really a nice thing to see as opposed to, you know, you get down to where the lowest one and you've got a total in of, what was that one, 85. So you've got 336, which is moderately good sized. But again, it takes fewer of those kids to not retain to get that lower deal than it does for the others. So it's saying, and I really appreciate the fact that the most students, when I look at it, are in those bottom three cohort. I mean, that's a lot of kids in comparison to some of the others. So that's a positive from my perspective.
Great.
I do have
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you provide us a slide or the data later that breaks this out by school? And that way we can look at the tuition or the counseling we're giving and what method versus retention. That would be a good data to have, I think. I don't know if the chair has agreed, but we could look at that in more detail, the council.
To compare the first-year experience to the retention rates?
Yes. Yeah.
Again, and I'll just say what they would probably say, which is it is still a small pot of data. It's only two terms, yeah, right.
But we're getting ready to do.
Yeah, amen. I know. I appreciate it, sir.
Madam Co-Chairman, Representative Wisnett, we certainly will follow up and give you that, provide with that information.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The Oregon Promise, the amount of dollars dispersed for the fall and winter, as you can see here, the largest amount of disbursements for both fall and winter in the EFC range of $5,000 to $9,999. It is important to note again that's the EFC range for which students cease to be eligible for the federal Pell Grant. And those students, if they're not eligible for the Pell Grant, then the Oregon Promise picks up some costs. And as you recall, this is a last dollar program as it is designed to come in after the Pell and after the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Any questions with this table?
Senator Roblin?
Not necessarily a question, just a comment. I mean, when we look at who gets the most money, again, it's even though it's the least amount that they get in those zero, the first three Koch groups, they brought in, they took in a lot of money, and the next highest is right, that first one, that first group kind of that qualifies, that doesn't get Pell, is still the highest. So distribution-wise, it's still going to those kids that have the least as opposed to the kids that have the most. When you look at the down to the 100,000 up people, 2%. I mean, it's not being, it is still being dispersed as we look at it by income, almost exclusively when you look through that percentage of distribution. I know that they get more because they aren't getting the Pell, but the reality is the money is being dispersed pretty clearly to the people with the least amount, to the people with the most. I think. Is that what I've heard?
I would also point out that 10% of the money is going to kids with family incomes of $155,000 and above, which is not insignificant.
Now, this is a projection of cost, a flatline scenario. And this provides you with
that look like it supports his position.
This scenario assumes that we would have no tuition increases, no changes to the eligibility criteria, or no changes to the cost sharing $50 copay that we have. And it also assumes the current student level participation rates. As you can see, the estimated dollars dispersed for this current academic year is about $112,000. And the estimated disbursements for 2017-18 is estimated to be, under this scenario, about $20,487,361. Now, keep in mind, that would include Cohort 1 students going into their second year and the new Cohort 2 students starting in the following year. For 2018-19, the estimated disbursement there is $24,051,660, and that would include the remaining Cohort 1 students who are still finishing up to their 90 credits, the second year of Cohort 2 students, and the first year of Cohort 3 students. For the biennium, the estimated biennial administrative cost is about $49,155. If you look at that administrative cost as a percentage of the combined total disbursement, it's a very small fraction of that cost.
And can you just give us a sense, is that FTE? Is that?
It's the cost of
FTE. Is
that
a cost at HEC or a cost at the community colleges?
It's
both.
It's the cost at OSAC. To HEC to administer the program. So predominantly it is FTE. We do have some ongoing assistance from programmers in our IT department, staff that critically review the application, staff that are available responding to students, creating seminars for families on how to interface with the program, and for individuals. And as time allows, making presentations at local high schools or coordinating with Aspire folks and other outreach individuals to share the details of the program and the information how to apply with the program. So a lot of variety of tasks, multifaceted tasks that the staff must conduct.
And can I just review on a numbers front? So this pays for a maximum of 12 credits per term. Is the assumption 3 terms per year or 4? I'm just trying to do the math of how you get to 90 at 12 a term in 2 years.
We will have a very interesting
chart. I'm not really sure how that works.
Following up that kind of gets into that.
Okay.
But this does assume a students taking about 12 credits of what we've seen this this year, so up to 12 credits per term.
Madam Co-Chair, on that point, it is the case. Your math is right. At 12 credits per term, 3 terms per year, a student would take more than 2 years to exhaust their 90 credits unless they've arrived at college already with credits under their belt, which would count towards their 90-credit maximum. It's part of the reason why for 2018-19, you see here 3 cohorts, because some of Cohort 1 is still eligible for the program, even if they've been enrolled up to 12 credits per term for 2 complete years. I did, before we leave this slide, and I think you've noted it, picked up on it, but this $419,000 for an entire biennium to run a brand new program serving almost 7,000 students in its first term with marketing, outreach, IT, program development. This was an enormous lift, and this reflects the extraordinary efforts really at OSAC to run a new program, deliver a new program with very little new administrative costs, about 1% of the total program costs.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
And so, just for my own understanding, so are all of these kids community college kids, or we have some of these kids are in the traditional four-year college?
They're all community college.
All community college.
Yes.
So this does not extend to kids who, say, get what I did. I got 36 credits in a community college, and that was enough for me to transfer into the university system. So this does not follow them, those kids.
Correct.
There.
Co-chair.
Mr. Co-chair.
Yeah. When we created this program, the idea was to try to make it possible for every student that had at least a 2.5 GPA, high school GPA, to go to college if they wanted to, and that the college of last resort was community college. Many of them still go to a private university or one of our 7 universities, in which case they're not in this program. The question is, do we know, or is it too early to tell, whether we have actually increased the percentage of students that have been successful in high school actually going to college immediately after leaving high school? Does this program work? Is it increasing the number of students? Because if we're ever going to get to 40-40-20, we've got to increase the number of students that start college right after high school and that complete either a 2-year associate type degree or go on and get some kind of a 4-year degree, or an apprenticeship program also would get us there. That's my question. We assume, and those of us that helped put this program together a couple of years ago, were hoping that it would increase precipitously the number of high school graduates that have been successful, 2.5 or better, that actually go immediately into some kind of a college program.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, when we presented on the Oregon Promise during our phase one presentation, we showed you data that compared the high school class of 2016, the first class that was eligible for this program, to the high school class, unfortunately, of 2014, because we had some lag in the data. And between those two, the difference is that in 2016, at least 844 more graduates went into a community college directly out of high school, largely, presumably, attributable to the Oregon Promise. That was offset to some extent by a small decline in the number of high school graduates who went and enrolled in an Oregon public university or an independent college or university anywhere in the country. We don't have the precise figures there. That 844 underestimates the boost for reasons that I won't get into, and we don't know precisely the way in which it was offset by slight declines in students matriculating into 4-year colleges and universities. But it is clear that more students from the high school, Oregon's high school class of 26, enrolled directly in post-secondary than had been the case 2 years before. And we're still working on getting a more precise answer. But I think it is the probably very most important question that we should be able to answer now or very soon.
Thank you.
So I have two more members with questions, and then I want to try to push us forward because we do have a number of proposals that we asked them to bring about potential cost controls going forward, and we still have two more topics to get to. Yes. So Representative Parrish and then Senator Roebling.
On a previous screen, and I don't remember how far back it is, but you know, you had sort of the income piece and expected family contribution, sort of some of the higher income folks. Do you have any data for us at all? If the expected contribution, say, is for somebody who's in that $60,000 to $100,000 range, and so otherwise, if this wasn't in existence, they probably wouldn't qualify for Pell Grant. Are those families, if they're sending their kids to college, are they paying cash? Because I think we have sometimes some assumptions about if you're a higher income earner, you just have disposable cash sitting around. Are they paying cash, or do we have any data on how many of kids in that income range before the promise were actually having to take out student loans? I mean, I didn't support this bill largely because I didn't think we had the money to make these kind of promises, and here we are in a budget cycle where we don't. However, I think if we are going to have programs, we need to make sure that, you know, we really are looking at the factors that keep kids out of debt at any income range. I mean, I still pay $800 a month in student loans. I don't love that payment every month. But I think that I would like to see, if you don't already have it, data on that cohort who are post-Pell, if those kids come in and pay tuition with cash, or if we are also indebting those kids because, you know, somewhere there's got to be some data on that, of how they pay for their tuition. If they don't qualify for Pell, they don't qualify for work study, they don't qualify for the NEED grant, we're making sometimes some assumptions that those parents are just writing cash checks, and I don't know that that's the right assumption to make.
Representative Parrish, co-chairs, the state doesn't get keep data on borrowers or borrowing. However, in conjunction with our college financial aid offices and potentially the national sort of research literature, we may be able to make a stab at the answer around sort of borrowing rates by, but we don't. The state doesn't act as a lender, nor does it get the student borrowing data. So we won't have data with the kind of precision that we're reporting here around the promise, but we'll attempt to provide some sense of the answer to that question.
And I would guess, Representative, that there's a pretty big difference as you go down that EFC scale as well. Because I think that, to me, the most compelling thing about that is, indeed, you are hitting a lot of those folks who are exactly who we want to hit, who don't qualify for Pell, but don't have the capacity to write a check for this stuff. And that's great, because that is exactly who we want to focus on. And at the same time, you've also got this chunk at the top who have a pretty significant expected family contribution. And that to me, is an expected family contribution of $100,000 versus $20,000 is pretty apples and oranges. So I think it'd be, and I would imagine the numbers are different for that. Who takes out loans, who pays for it?
And like I said, I think that for me, my concern is sometimes we make assumptions about people generically. If you're at a certain income level, therefore you can buy your health care, you can buy your education, you can buy all these things. But I think that there is, even if one community college could produce it, our kids who have a high expected family contribution and we don't give them a financial aid package, are those kids then subsequently turning to debt to finance their community college? And I think that's a missing piece of this conversation as we make decisions about how to move forward with this program at the sort of the next layer of, do we fund it and do we keep it and who gets to access it? And I think we have to have that data to make some kind of determination.
Senator Roebling?
So the other thing we were trying to do with this program was to increase the amount of money from the federal government supporting our community colleges. Mm-hmm. Did that happen? Did we get more money from the federal government than we have had in the past because of this program?
Senator Roebling, co-chairs, we don't have a definitive answer today, but I believe that we can get back to you with a sort of cohort-to-cohort analysis. For example, these recent high school graduates 2016 versus recent high school graduates who went to community college in 2014 and the number of them who received Pell, I think you are likely to see some, because we saw an overall increase in the number of students going to community college directly out of high school. I think that will be true at all levels, including for Pell recipients, and we'll work on getting that information to you.
Great. Representative, and then we need to go ahead.
Didn't you testify in the committee, policy committee, that the FASA, whatever, are way up, and that's...
Yes, Representative Wisnick, co-chair Smith Warner. Oregon saw the nation's largest year-over-year increase in the percentage of high school seniors who completed their FAFSAs, over 10% increase 2016 versus 2015. Again, sort of leading to likely to the conclusion that there was an increase in Pell Grants as well that year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think we're at page 22, or slide 22.
So just quickly, this is material that we talked about, and this chart provides you with that timeline to reach 90. Obviously, if students are taking 12 credits, an average of 12 credits, it will take them a little bit longer than six terms, more than two academic years to get to that magic 90. If they were to take a higher number, say, for example, 15, they could get to 90 in six terms. So moving on to the next slide, the potential cost drivers and some of the scenarios that we'll be discussing. So cost drivers to keep in mind that we're going to be reviewing is any changes in the number of participants. So if the number of participants goes up in any one of the EFC categories, you will see an increase of cost. If the number is reduced, you will see a decrease, of course, projected increase. Changes in the economic profile of these participants. So if you have more Pell-eligible students, more dollars coming into our state, less demand on Oregon Promise resources. The inverse is also true. If you see an increase of students who are not eligible for Pell, you would see an increase in cost of the program. Any changes that the federal government may make to the Pell Award would also impact us, as well as any changes to the Oregon Opportunity Grant Awards. And the changes that the Oregon Promise and to the Oregon Promise copays, currently we have a $50 copay, and we'll show you some information on how a change in that copay would affect the cost of the program, as well as any changes to the eligibility criteria, whether it's increasing or decreasing the GPA. We'll review a scenario of a decrease in the GPA. Few uncertainties and unknowns to keep in mind as we review these scenarios is that new cohorts may be different in future years. Every generation is different. Those of you that worked in the K-12 system will know that every classroom, every generation is a bit different than the other. And high school graduates, while they've been, the number has been relatively flat in our state, we don't know if we will see similar numbers or if we see an increase or a decrease. That's a variable that is out there. And the cost, the true service level cost, is still unknown. It's a new program. And also the tuition, if there's a tuition percentage increase, and we'll get into that scenario. Do keep in mind that the data for this program that we have available is for less than one full academic year. So that is, let's take it with a little bit of a grain of salt and not rely too much on that year one, two term information. When we have two full years, I believe we'll have to be a bit more solid in terms of how this program applies. So this table provides you with the projected cost for 2017-19 biennium of a tuition increase. And there's two projections here. It's a 5% and a 7% projection. The 5%, which we'll call it a baseline case, would produce an estimated disbursement amount of $48,033,455 and an increase of $3,494,000. The tuition increase at a 7% each year in the biennium would create a total estimated disbursement amount of $49,463,084. Any questions?
Madam Chair, just to put things in perspective, the co-chair's framework has the Oregon Promise program at $40 million. That's what the known amount was at the time. With the increase in the first two quarters, that number jumps. That funding, whether it's 48 or 49 million, is not included right now, making these alternatives that much more important. Mm-hmm. And the framework also included, I believe it was a $5 million reduction from that $40 million based on some cost-cutting option.
So moving on, the cost control options that have been modeled for you is the adjustment of the co-pays, increase in the co-pays for all students, or increase in the co-pay only for those in higher EFC ranges, and then establishing some EFC or income limits. We'll review that as well. And the adjustments to the GPA, lowering the GPA requirement to a 2.0 would increase costs. And the other will be the reduction of the maximum award amount. So at the top end, the average amount, reducing that can produce some reduction in overall costs. So first, the copay scenarios. So you can see here in this table from the baseline, or the baseline case, if we were to eliminate the $50 copay, it would produce a cost increase of $3,425,013. So it's an impact of about 7.1%. Inversely, if we were to increase the copay to $100 per term, would reduce the cost by $3,425,013. Now, keep in mind, increasing the copay for students with an EFC of zero would have a larger impact than a student with an EFC of $100,000. Increasing the copay to $100 per term for those recipients with an EFC greater than $10,000 could produce a cost reduction from the baseline of $255,000. Increasing the copay to those recipients with an EFC greater than $15,000 would produce a difference of $912,000, a reduction of $912,000, $12,807. So these are different scenarios of adjusting the copay downward and upward for different EFC ranges.
Okay.
Senator Roblin?
So rather than adjusting copays, if we just adjusted the amount, the maximum amount they could get by the same amount, would that be better because we wouldn't have the issue of managing it?
We will be reviewing that a little bit.
Okay.
In a couple of slides. So this slide provides you with a detailed outline of reducing or setting EFC limits, establishing EFC limits for eligibility criteria can create the most significant cost control differences from the baseline. The lower the EFC eligibility limit, the higher the cost reduction, as you can see. Setting an eligibility limit at 10,000 EFC would produce a $23 million cost difference from the baseline. And setting an eligibility limit at $20,000 EFC or 20,000 EFC would set a difference of $10 million, $630,000. So quite a bit of difference, quite a bit of impact in comparison to the copay scenarios that you saw. Any thoughts, questions, reflections on this? So lowering the GPA limit to 2.0, this would have the impact of opening up the program to more students, of course. And OSAC did a survey of Aspire sites to try to get at GPAs, average GPAs in our state. And what we learned is that about 15% of students and the class of 2016 had a GPA between 2.0 and
and 2.5. So that's a range of students and a potential increase. So when you see the increase here estimated at 10% of students, if we were to apply that beginning in 2018-19, you would see an increase in difference from the baseline of $2 million. If it was applied at 50%, or if we experienced a 50% increase in the number of students, because all of a sudden students would learn that if you had a 2.0 GPA, you could apply and participate in this program, we could see a result of up to 15%. And that difference from the baseline would be $3,975,534. Moving on to the next. Now, cost control by reducing the maximum award amount. This is the maximum award amount of the upper end of the awards. As you know, there's a base minimum for full-time student at $1,000 up to the maximum average amount for a community college. Now, reducing that amount by 5%, holding it about 2016-17 level, it would produce a $1 million difference from the baseline. Decreasing it by 10% would reduce the cost by $2,789,000. And then further decreasing that by 15% would produce a cost reduction of $4,363,374. So it can create an impact because you are paying out the maximum level less than you would otherwise would be.
And to Senator Roblin's question, if I may, this change, reducing the maximum award amount, would not affect most of the lower income students whose award is based on that $1,000 cap because they're typically Pell and Opportunity Grant eligible. This particular change would not impact them.
Okay, Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Monroe?
I would sure hope that the school counselors starting in the 8th and 9th grade would be telling their students that they need to keep their grades up to at least 2.5 if they want to be eligible for this program and have their basically have a guarantee that their college will be paid for. I don't know if it'll do any good. High school students, aren't real good usually at planning ahead, and they don't think about the fact that, gee, what I'm doing today may have an effect on the rest of my life. But we ought to try.
Senator Roblin?
And along that line, I, as this goes on, I think we can get more subtle and just say your last 2 years is 2.5 as opposed to the whole, because there are a lot of kids who do get that message, but they get it late. Mm-hmm. And if you start out with a 1 point whatever, what you have to get up to 2.5 those for the overall is not good. And I would love to figure out a way to reward those kids that who get the message while they're in high school that I need to go on, I need to get back into here. And right now, you get punished really hard by the decisions you made in that freshman and sophomore year. And so for me, that's a bigger conversation. I want to continue to have the conversation and get them engaged. But if you've already messed up so much, it's hard to get them back to engage if you don't give them something to look forward to.
Okay, go ahead.
So other cost control factors that were not modeled here, of course, increasing the GPA limit from 2.5 to 3.0. That would reduce the number of eligible applicants. Or setting some sort of increase in the copay, setting a tier approach to the copay at higher EFC ranges. That's something that we didn't model here. Or the enrollment status, for example, if we were to limit award amounts or awards to only students who were attending full-time, that could have the potential of a slight cost increase, but would also promote more timely completions. Limiting the awards to full-time or only half-time rather than fractions of a above a halftime would simplify awarding, so it would be a reduction and some costs. And the other would be adjusting the award amounts, creating some sort of tiered approach by income or EFC limits. So it's similar to increasing or decreasing the maximum award amount.
Representative Parrish.
So, where does the kind of idea around GPA come? I can understand income, but I want to piggyback a little bit on Senator Roman's comment. I know one of the states that, maybe it's Georgia, that has the program, and I think they just, as a cost savings measure, they went to GPA. But I do want to caution us that I think GPA is not a performance metric when you get a kid who starts going in college. And, you know, for lots of reasons, kids do sort of wash out in high school and you get into this kind of cumulative piece. And I think if we're going to have a conversation about cost control, my preference would be to not tie it to GPA. And, you know, I look at my own high school child who barely is going to squeak the 2.5 out of high school, but he's taking classes at the community college right now, and he's on the honor roll at the community college. So I just really want us to be thoughtful. And, you know, and I would not have qualified for the Oregon Promise. I got a 2.0 in high school is what I graduated with. So, but it didn't stop me from being on the honor roll in my master's program. So I really want us to think that this is not a cost, GPAP should not be a cost containment measure, because I think we're excluding kids who have the potential to go into a different environment of the college structure and thrive when the social pressures in high school and lots of other things, you know, are sort of driving a child's academic performance in high school that are not related to the academics at all.
Hormones.
All manner of things. Bowling. You know, one of the things that came out of our school board race was parents being most worried about drugs, alcohol, suicide, and bowling is the negative thing that is impacting them and their children in our schools. And so that is going to
bullying. Yeah. We all thought you were saying bowling.
Like,
how can bowling be bad?
That has a negative impact and is certainly something that puts stress into a child and drives academics down. But again, when those kids hit a community college, they thrive in that setting because they feel like they, you know, right, wrong, or otherwise, they have more control over what they're taking, when they take it, how they structure their day. Some of those social pressures go away and are alleviated, and then kids can thrive. So I don't love the GPA piece as a cost containment measure.
As Representative Parrish, I think you would find a lot of support for that perspective from the community college presidents themselves. I think in addition to all of the points that you've raised about let's just call them the non-cognitive, non-academic factors in high school and the influence they have on high school GPA, I know in my conversations with the community college presidents, setting a GPA requirement runs counter to the open access mission and philosophy of the institutions. So I've heard a lot of support for, at minimum, not raising the GPA, and in some cases, either lowering or eliminating the GPA entirely.
Senator Roblin?
I think that when we were working on this program, two things were paramount to making the program successful. An easy message that says all kids get a grant, which causes some people angst because wealthier people can also take advantage of it. But the other issue was that we had to keep it within $10 million because that's what the law said we had. So you look at that and decide how best to get to that $10 million and have a simple message. The only parameter you could switch was GPA, and that limited. I agree 100%. I would love to have no GPA. And so we have to look at some of these other things that can cut some costs. But at the end of the day, if we end up with a complex message to tell people who gets to apply and who doesn't get to apply, or who gets a grant and who doesn't get a grant, all of a sudden we lose some of the advantage of the program by saying if you're an Oregon student and you have a 2.5, you get your community college paid. Keeping it going and making sure that people take advantage of whatever we offer, I think, is really important. So we need that's. But that is exactly where it came.
That part is where
right.
I have an issue.
Yeah. I would definitely. And I had a lot of kids when our high school who made that switch, and getting back to a 2.0 or 2.5 was almost impossible. And some of them, because they did well on some testing, because they were really bright, they just didn't care about school, ended up going to very exclusive universities with really large amounts of money from foundations paying their way. And I'm happy that we could find those places for people, but it doesn't happen for everybody.
Senator Murray.
And following up, Representative Parrish, I do not support raising the tuition as a cost-saving matter, or the GPA. I absolutely don't. If we have to cap something, we should cap the maximum award, which would only affect the highest income students. I hope we don't have to do that, but if we have to cap anywhere, that would be my preference. I mean, I had a 2.7 GPA in high school and straight A's in college, so you know, what you have in high school, some of us learned at some point along the line that studying was a good thing.
So in courtesy to the Lynn Benton president, who is here and has been patiently waiting, do you want to go? I know we're almost done with this, and then you have one last slide. Anything you want to highlight on that?
I think
we've
slide,
kind of talked through a lot of these, but.
Madam Co-Chair, just quickly highlighting that another cost control that we did not model is basing the award amounts on 15 credits per term, which would increase cost, but also get students to completion much faster. And as you can see, there's other considerations to keep in mind in terms of the cost controls. Should we establish any cost controls? How will it affect the new cohort students only, or is there a possibility for the state to grandfather awards for those who would no longer meet the award limits, but who started with, for example, cohort one? And then how do we accommodate new student cohorts if we're grandfathering awards for other students? So those are things for all of us to process. And of course, the cost, I think it's worth considering at some point in time, doing a calculation of the maximum, the cost of extending up to 15 credits per term, because that is something that we have heard from community colleges, from parents, from advocates, because that is the magic number that numerically would get students in a two-year window to 90 credits. So thank you.
To be clear,
much.
A student can choose to take 15 and pay for those three extra credits, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. And I'd like to call up the co-chair, and I do not have our usual 9:45 meeting with big chairs today, so we are happy to give at least 10, if not more, minutes to the next presentation. We're gonna ask Andrea Henderson to come back to talk about the high-cost programs, and we'll pick a date for that shortly. But I would like to welcome her and Greg Hammond, the president of Lynn Benton, to speak about property taxes in the community college formula.
And Madam Co-Chair, I don't regret that we've taken an inordinate amount of time, because the discussion this morning has been so critical to the future of our young people in this state. So I'm hoping that things we didn't get to, that we'll be able to invite folks back and not give a short shift to what these folks have to share with us.
Amen.
For the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. I think we also had some slides for this presentation that will.
Michael, can you help me find the other slides?
So we were asked to come in and talk briefly about how property taxes work in the funding formula. And I wanted to start by just pointing out that the whole process of moving to including property taxes in the funding formula is a direct result of the passage of Measure 5. Prior to the passage of Measure 5, most of the funding from community colleges came from local property taxes, about 50% of the funding. As Measure 5 was implemented, that really shifted to a point where about 50% of the funding came from the state. At that point, the colleges made a decision to kind of equalize the property taxes to be fair for all students. So I'm going to turn it over to Greg Hayman, our president from Lynn Benton Community College, who's also our chair of President's Council and our resident expert on the formula, to talk a little more detail about how that works.
Oh, boy, what an insult. for the record, Greg Hayman, Lynn Benton Community College Chair Warner and committee, thank you for the time to talk about a subject that almost nobody ever wants to hear about. Some details of our funding distribution model. As Andrea Henderson has indicated, subsequent to Measure 5, not immediately, but subsequent to Measure 5, we began to think about how, with our property tax resources essentially frozen or to within certain limits, and you'll see on the screen here how that has impacted us. We recognize that as the state funding became more and more important to us as an institution, that that we saw significant inequities in terms of the amount of money that was provided to serve each of our students statewide. And so we began to discuss how to create a more equal support for those students. And that really was the basis for the work around a project that we called Equalization, which started about 9 years, 10 years ago, in which we made a very significant change in our funding distribution formula, and then we took 6 years to implement it, which essentially said we were going to distribute state resources amongst the 17 institutions sort of as a backfill to local property taxes, so that the total public resources for each student, regardless of the community colleges that they attended, they would receive the same amount of property tax plus state support on a per-student basis. So that is where we are now. It took us a while to get there. So when we think about resources, we think about the combination of total public resources, which is that state funding, plus our local property taxes, and then also our own resources, which are predominantly tuition and fees. And that creates the about 98% of the funding for providing the educational opportunities that we provide to our students. You want more information on that?
Can I ask, can we go to that first slide with the graph?
Sure.
So can you talk through a little bit? What's interesting to me is that since 07, 08, since knowing that, you know, the economy went in the tank, and it looks like community colleges broadly were successful I just see that, and I assume they passed a bunch of bonds or did something so that their revenues went up significantly in that chunk and passed. It was probably a combination of need and want of state support went down and property taxes went up. Is that just from the implementation of the formula, or were indeed a bunch of new property taxes passed?
The three revenue sources you see there are tuition fees, property taxes, and state general fund. What you see is that property taxes have been, as a percent of our funding per student, remained almost constant over time.
Oops, I was reading the wrong line. Yep.
Right. And what you see is that the other revenue source, which is tuition, has a very clear inverse relationship to state funding. When state funding goes up, tuition becomes a smaller proportion of our funding per student. When state funding goes down, tuition becomes a higher. And you can see a very direct inverse relationship between those two funding sources.
Thank you. I was reading that wrong.
Okay. Looks like a mirror.
Almost, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, that's. I think that's important for all of us to recognize. Yeah.
And so, if the rate changes in any of the catchments, that then impacts the formula. Do you take that into account with the formula, or are these rates set and can never be changed?
Sure. So, Madam Co-Chair, these rates are for the most part set in stone because of Measure 547 and 50. And so that's part of the rationale for the equalization, is the rates were just essentially frozen in time in terms of whatever was in place in 1990. And so because of that, equalization becomes more important. There are a few colleges that might be slightly under the $5 limit, but it's very small. And we have not seen any colleges that have gone out for a local option under compression and been successful with it. So it really is, rates are set in stone based on this. And as you can see, there's a wide variation in rates. Because there is a $5 limit for all of education, generally speaking, those colleges that have a smaller rate and receive less property taxes is offset by a local K-12 district that receives a higher amount.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
And this says absolutely nothing about capital and the ability to raise capital. Again, my college, Mount Hood, failed for the 19th time, well, I think it's 8th or 9th time, to pass a capital budget. As a result, they're not going to be able to do the match with the state money that's available for badly needed projects. On the other hand, in downtown Portland, you can pass anything. So it really is unfair, and until we find some kind of way to equalize capital needs and the ability to meet capital needs, we really aren't doing the whole job.
Senator Monroe and members of the committee, I think we would agree. Yeah.
But
Representative Leibman.
I'm sorry, Member. So, but from the standpoint of the rate, the capital is outside of that on Measure 5.
Right.
And so, right.
Completely.
Yeah.
Great. My other question is, has this been, how has the completion incentive in the funding formula been implemented? Has that impacted that at all? Is that has been being rolled out by HEC? And I know that's only
Chair Warner,
and I'm using the wrong word.
We do not currently have a completion component in our funding distribution model.
Only on the university side?
Right.
Okay. Good to know. Would you care to say anything else about that, either one of you? I think you would not. Anyone else?
I would.
Senator Roblin.
I think, from my perspective, in community colleges and what we ask them to do, that would not be a favorable expectation for them, because we ask them to pick up everybody else's problems and to do what they can do with them. And I believe that any college they take at the community increases their ability to get a job and do other kinds of things. So from my perspective, it's not quite as important completion-wise. We don't incur quite the debt, and we do try to help every Oregon citizen improve their lot by taking courses at community colleges. So I think they have a different mission, so I would hope we don't get into too many battles about that, personally.
Senator Roblin and members of the committee, I do respect that perspective. I would also note that nationally and in our 40-40-20 objectives as a state, we do believe that completion at the community college level is critically important to our mission as community colleges. We have a variety of missions, which certainly are broader, more comprehensive than a university. But completion still matters to us, and it matters to us greatly.
Thank you both for.
So if you have extra money for a bonus as opposed to taking it from the. I think it would be great to put a completion component in.
Okay. Thank you both for being here.
And Madam Co-Chair, we can learn a lot from Greg and from what he's done at Lynn Benton. They're leading in many ways.
Thank you.
Especially in transferability and work with the university system. I applaud you.
Senator Roberts?
Appreciate that.
I want to say the same thing. We had a hearing in education yesterday with regard to ability for students to talk about their fees and to distribute those fees in the ways they wanted, and almost all of them, who were very articulate, now do not go to Lynn Benton Community College, but they all originated there, and they all appreciated the opportunity they had to learn about and to be a part of the conversation about student fees. So they were, without regard, very complimentary of their experience at Lynn Benton Community College. So I just thought that you should.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, thank you. Yes, I know all of them by name.
Thank you both for being here. Thank you for that information. Andrea, if you wanted to speak to the, I know we had you on the list for the Oregon Promise and didn't end up getting to you, so I wanted to give you that opportunity before we close the meeting today.
Great. Thank you very much. I'd like to make three quick points about the Oregon Promise from the community college perspective. First, as we talk about the purpose of the Oregon Promise, and there was quite a bit of conversation today about does it get more students in the door? And I think as important is it closing the achievement gap. And so as we're looking at students in poverty, we're looking at underrepresented students. Are we making a difference for those students that haven't traditionally succeeded in post-secondary education? And that, to us, is as critical of a question as are we getting more students in the door? Secondly, as we look at some of the choices to be made, at the top of our priority list is to drop the GPA requirement. For those students who do not receive a 2.5 in high school, we know that most of the jobs now require something beyond high school, and we're further disadvantaging those students who don't have the opportunity to attend community college for free. And keep in mind, at the community college, it's not just transfer students. We also have very robust programs that are both certificate and two-year programs in our various career technical areas. Right. And to have that opportunity for all students to be able to get the credentials that they need for a family wage job is critically important in this economy. And so as we are looking at trade-offs, we would certainly recommend dropping the GPA requirement. And if there's other ways we can make trade-offs, particularly in the higher income students with the higher EFCs, that's a trade-off that we would choose to make.
I wanted her to get through her three points.
Go ahead.
Okay. And then the last point is really about the money that was complementary to the program last session. In addition to the money for the first-year experience, which is critically important and does make a difference for students, there was also funding provided for advisors. $1.5 million was added to the budget. It paid for either one advisor for the smaller colleges, two advisors for the larger colleges. As we discussed at last session, there wasn't an anticipation that that would continue. And that is critically important. And many of the colleges have indicated that they do not have the funding to continue those advisors without help from the legislature. And so we would also really place that as one of our priorities, is to continue the funding for advisors and for the first year experience, because those make a tremendous difference in the success of these students.
Cool. Did you want
to? I just wanted to, Chair Warner and the committee as a whole, I just wanted to add a quick comment on Oregon Promise. I think that as a state, represent the completion of high school as being either career or college ready, it would seem consistent with that if you graduate from high school, you should also be eligible for the opportunities to support them in that career or college opportunity beyond it. And so I think we have, it's certainly our mission as a community college to provide access and success to those students who probably are least likely to have access to and success elsewhere. And so we are critically concerned about that gap. And I do understand the cost implications of that, but that's pretty critical to our mission. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, and then
the one point you didn't get to, high cost programs that have high results, that cost more at the community college level, but that result in family wage jobs virtually guaranteed. Should the state be doing something differentially to fund those kinds of programs at a higher level than regular community college programs that are much less costly?
Senator Monroe and members of the committee, we certainly are interested in receiving support for programs that are high cost. I think our concern would be that it would be a shifting of resources away from other programs. So you're absolutely right. We have some extremely expensive programs at our institution. We're expanding those programs at a pretty rapid pace, and that creates fiscal challenges for us as an institution. Yeah. So your recognition of that is appreciated.
And we don't have the money.
Yes. He will spend that time. We're looking at a place to schedule that. Senator Roblin?
Two comments to that one. The first one is, when we were having our conversation about Promise, we were also having a conversation about fifth year, a separate kind of fifth year program with colleges, mostly schools in the Valley. The changes with Promise have reduced the numbers that are doing that dramatically. And if we reduce the GPA, it would go away, because the only people that are now being served by those fifth-year programs in the Valley are those kids that don't have a 2.5 GPA, by giving them that extended year that they have done. If Promise didn't have a GPA deal, that program would go away completely. So I know that Senator would love to improve the deal of making it go away. So I'm just giving him one opportunity to do that. The other opportunity is that if we go back to funding all programs at the community colleges, including those that are enrichment, they could take the money that they get from those and redistribute them to those high-cost programs that we all think need to have more money. I will never stop saying that.
I do not expect you to.
We have heard it before.
Again, thank you both, Andrea. We will reschedule you to have that conversation about high-cost community college programs. And with that, colleagues, we are adjourned. And we will see you all next Monday at 8:30. Next Monday at 8:30. We will see you all.